So in 2022, we saw the rise, I think, or the comeback, I should say, of trend strategies. So these are strategies that, you know, basically make money when there is a clear breakout in prices. And when does that happen? Well, when there is a lot of macro volatility, you would expect that there are more convex reactions in prices, and therefore trend strategies can actually benefit from this ability. And you can see that trend strategies tend to do pretty well during inflationary bouts, exactly for this reason, because you need to restructure the way you think about interest rates and equity sectors and commodity prices. And so you have a lot of trends developing, and you can benefit from an allocation to trend.
Hello, and welcome to the Resolve Risks Investment Podcast, where the science of investing meets real-world application. Join Adam Butler, Mike Philbrick, Rodrigo Gordillo, and Richard Latterman of Resolve Asset Management as they bring their extensive investment experience to bear on deep dives into the current market trends, optimal portfolio construction, and risk management techniques helping animate the world of quantitative investing with a global macro perspective. This podcast is a must-listen for professional capital allocators seeking to navigate the complexities of global markets with skill and confidence. Welcome to the journey.
Adam Butler, Mike Philbrick, and Rodrigo Gordillo are principals of Resolve Asset Management Global. All opinions expressed by the principals are their own and do not express the opinion of Resolve Asset Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. For more information, visit investresolve.com.
All right, welcome to another episode of Resolve Riffs, where we have today one of our most popular guests that we have on a regular basis, Alfonso Picatillo, who's joining us today, otherwise known as @MacroElf on Twitter, and is the publisher of The Macro Compass. Alfonso, welcome back to Resolve Riffs, and it's great to have you joining us today.
One of my favorite shows, regular listener, so always a pleasure to be here.
Love it. You have been a busy beaver, as they say in Canada. I know you've got a fund you're working on that looks like it might be an idea that might be coming to fruition in Q4, and you have been continually writing as eloquently as you do, and as I think you have such great explanatory power in your narratives and things like that. So let's jump in and talk about, you know, how did we get here, the fiat system and the end game. You released a video just today, actually, which I thought was a wonderful way to sort of set the table of what we've been going through over the last 50 years, you know, contextually, maybe in a broader sense of how fiat currencies have come about, how they've developed. And you coined a phrase, the wealth illusion paradigm, which I thought was a really, really interesting concept. So why don't we start there? Talk through that recent piece you had, and then we'll continue through the rest of the show, and we'll get to the fund you're working on and how it's going to position itself within that framework and how asset prices might respond and all that stuff.
All right, let's do that. So the piece was called The Macro Endgame, because I think, you know, macro investors in general, investors, we're always inundated with daily news and noise and data. And now that the market is pretty boring, we can maybe take a step back. Right? We take a step back and we can look at the big picture, answering the million-dollar question, you know, what is the macro endgame? Because I think it feels a bit unsustainable for many looking at the ways we have structured our financial system. When you look at wealth inequality, when you look at asset prices, it often gives you that feeling that it's not really a very sustainable equilibrium, right? It's a bit what Minsky would say, artificial stability breeds instability in the system. That's how many people feel about it. That's why maybe they want to have some gold, or for, you know, more digital age oriented people, maybe Bitcoin. That's the feeling, I think, right? And I wanted to try and explain, how did we get here? Why do you have this feeling, and whether this system can actually be resistant, or whether it actually breaks? And if it breaks, what's the macro end game? That was the idea behind the piece. And so it all starts in 1971, when Nixon ends the gold peg, right? It basically collapses the gold standard. And what he does back then is he basically ends the convertibility of gold into dollar at a fixed price, at a fixed exchange rate. And what happens back then is basically that all banks and governments in the world that were creating new money, and I will explain in a second what I mean with that, They were also creating new money before 1971, but there was a clear limit, a hard peg to this, because you would create dollars out of thin air like a government or a bank does, but then there would be a fixed price at which you could convert these dollars back into gold. And so you had to be careful with the amount of fiat money you would create, right? There was a balancing mechanism, in other words. And after 1971, that's not the case anymore. So in our system, it's not central banks that create inflationary money, and that comes as a news for many, but it's government via fiscal deficits and banks via lending that create the inflationary form of money we can actually spend. And how it works is pretty simple. The government is the issuer of the currency, so the United States government issues dollars. They control the issuance of the dollar. And what they do when they do fiscal deficits is they decide to basically, let's say, blow a hole in their balance sheet, so reduce their net worth, run deficits, and inject this net worth into the private sector. So in 2020, you could open your mailbox and find a $5,000 check from the United States that had become basically the issuer of this $5,000 for you, and you became richer because you could cash in the $5,000 at JP Morgan and have this spendable money now all of a sudden to spend without having a liability attached to it. You didn't have any debt, any mortgage, any loan, nothing. So your net worth went up because the United States government decided that its net worth had to go down. So it's a simple balancing mechanism where the government decides to blow a hole in their balance sheet, issue new spendable dollars, and you as the private sector will be the beneficiary of it. And the second way is bank lending, where you want to buy a house of $1 million. You don't have $1 million cash in your bank account, but what you have is a job or a business. So you will produce cash flows over time, and therefore a bank can look at your future purchasing power and give you credit against that now. So basically credit your bank account by $1 million, money you didn't have before, and now you can go and buy a house with the newly created $1 million from the bank, right? And the seller of the house will now have a new bank deposit of $1 million, who he didn't have before. So the creation of credit basically allows the balance sheets to grow, and it injects money into the system, although it comes with debt as well. Because you have $1 million, but you also have a mortgage of $1 million now. So that's a bit the difference, but it still allows you to spend more all of a sudden, to have more inflationary spending power than before. And after 1971, both the banks and the governments were more free to actually create new fiat money without having to convert or check the convertibility of this newly, of the quantity of the fiat money versus the dollar, because the gold peg was basically gone.
Yep.
And when you look at this, you say, okay, cool, but the fact that they can doesn't mean they will create a bunch of new fiat out of nowhere. And this is true, because if you think about why would government run a lot of deficits or the private sector demand a lot of credit from banks, you would do this if the organic growth in the private sector, if the structural growth of the private sector declines. So if you see your structural ability to generate growth going down, what you will be doing is look for an offset. And that offset is credit, deficits, more money being created to offset your inability to create strong structural growth. And that inability started to surface in the 80s, because the inability, and I can share the screen here to show what are the drivers of long-term economic growth, and they're pretty intuitive. One of the ways that you can create organic growth in an economy is through demographics. Pretty simple. Right. If you have more people working productively, then your structural GDP growth will be higher.
Yeah.
So one of the ways to create strong organic GDP growth is through demographics. So pretty simple, if the amount of working age population as a percentage of total increases, so you have more people actually contributing to your working, to your labor force, then you can have more structural growth. Vice versa, if your working age population shrinks, then you will have less people contributing to active economic growth, and your organic growth will also shrink. And as you can see from this chart, whether you take the United States or even Japan or Germany or Italy, up until the 80s, the amount of working age population was increasing. So you had basically a demographics boom in the post Second World War era that led 20 years later, because to make a new worker, you actually need 20 years, right? They need to be eligible to work. In the 80s, you had the peak of this working age population growth as percentage of total. So you had all countries basically ranging between 65 and 70% of working age population as percentage of total. But in the 80s, we peaked. Basically, demographics peaked. They remained healthy between the 80s and 2000, but the marginal growth, the marginal benefit from better demographics had exhausted. And if you look at the next 10 to 20 years, of course, these projections look bleaker and bleaker. So in the 80s, you had demographics peaking, and you also had the second factor that stands behind structural growth. You had productivity also peaking, because at the end of the day, you can have better demographics, but if those workers aren't productive, and if the use of capital isn't productive in the economy, you're still going to struggle. Now, the good news is, as you can see from this chart, that if you look at the decades like the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and all the ways until the 80s, productivity growth on a 10-year rolling basis was increasing. So you were becoming more productive year after year, and the marginal rate of productivity was also increasing. But once you reached the 80s and the 90s, this productivity growth was still there, but it started to decline on a second derivative basis. So you were still more productive, but the productivity growth benefits were mostly exhausted. And so what happened basically is that by the 80s and the 90s, you were in a situation where the gold peg was gone. You could create new money without having a hard peg to gold. And your structural growth forces, driven by demographics and productivity, were declining. And so politicians had to basically find an offset, a way to offset this dwindling structural growth to make GDP growth socially acceptable again. And how were they going to eat their 3% real GDP target each year? Well, with the use of leverage.
Right.
And therefore they said, you know what, we are going to start doing it, and we're going to lever up the system because we don't have a hard peg anymore. And we can create as much fiat money as we want. And so you go into a situation, as you can see here, where whatever country you actually put, you can use the US or Europe or Japan or China, as you can see in this chart. As long as you look at the total leverage in the system, so you look at the private sector, as we said, bank lending, private credit, and the public sector combined, if you look at the use of leverage you can make throughout the economy, all biggest economies in the world went through the same process. Between the 80s and 2020, they all levered up their economies from about 100, 150% of GDP all the way to 300, or in Japan case, even 400% of GDP.
Right. Wow. So that's public and private debt as a percentage of GDP that you've got on this. And you can just see in particular, what's striking is that run in China from, you know, sort of post 2008 at 100 and whatever, 20% to 300, just sort of catching up to the rest of the developed nations in the world. Truly staggering.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. I mean, China caught up to the game. They had demographics tailwinds a bit later than the others, so they lasted a little bit longer. They had a big productivity boom by joining the WTO, so they could gain share on the global manufacturing market, on the global trade market. They became more productive, but all this exhausted for them, let's say 10 to 15 years later than it did for the others. So somewhere around 2005, 2010, they actually had to lever up, and they did so very, They went ballistic, you know, in basically 15 years, they covered the ground for three decades when it comes to leverage. And so basically you went to a situation where politicians had found a fix. The fix was, well, if demographics are coming down and if productivity is coming down, we're going to do leverage and everybody's going to be fine. Now, one issue with leverage is that it makes the system, of course, a bit more fragile. And also, to be used as a recurring system, more leverage and more leverage and more leverage, you need to make sure that the next guy who's levering, the next generation who's levering, is able to do so at a marginally cheaper interest rate. So if you lever up the system more and more and more, and your salaries aren't increasing in real terms, and your structural growth is not that strong, the only way to sustain, to basically have a servicing ability for this high level of leverage, is to make servicing costs pretty low, is to make interest rates as low as possible. And so you went into a situation where the system got more leverage, often unproductive, to be frank. So this leverage went into real estate and asset prices. It wasn't really used to generate innovation and structural growth. So you had this system, this lowered economic activity, as the entire economy was basically burdened by that. And so central banks decided to stimulate economic growth and make the system more sustainable by lowering interest rates. This was the trick to continue levering up the system without having effectively a deleveraging episode like we had, for example, in Japan a system which was highly leveraged to the real estate market in the 80s. And when the Bank of Japan raised rates, you then had a deleveraging episode who lasted for decades. So the West didn't want that. And they said, well, you know what? We're going to cut rates and accommodate this process as we speak. And so that's what we did.
Yeah. And so that obviously, well, it's unlikely that that can go on forever. But maybe also walk through the steps of the wealth illusion effect that you talk about and how that continues to go through. Maybe the stepwise example that you use in the house purchase and let people sort of get their minds wrapped around that.
Yeah, correct. So one chart before we walk through the example to visualize what I just said. Mm-hmm. If you look at the US and you look at government and private sector debt as percentage of GDP, which is in blue on this axis inverted. So the lower you go, the more private and public sector debt in the US. Right? We were at 180% in 1998 in the US, and real interest rate in orange on the right-hand side were at about 4%. So with the US running 180% of private and public sector debt as a percentage of GDP, we could run in the US with about 3.5 to 4% real interest rates, okay? And now as the US became more and more leveraged and more leveraged, let's say all the way until today, with the US running 250% of private and public sector debt as percentage of GDP, real yields have been for the last decade somewhere around 1%, roughly 50 basis points to 1%. Now, the Federal Reserve has hiked interest rates much further in this specific economic cycle, which makes the system arguably a bit fragile, right? Because what you're having is a decent level of leverage in the system with real interest rates that are higher than what the equilibrium of the last 30 years between these two variables would suggest. But really, the other effect of doing this is boosting house prices or asset prices in general. So I'm now sharing part of the article I wrote just to make people visualize as well the figures that I'm using. So if you bought a house in the US, let's say in the early 90s, right? Let's assume for a second that the bank would have lent you 100% of the purchase value. That's not standard, but please bear with me just for the sake of the assumption, okay? So let's say in the 90s, you wanted to spend $1,000 a month in mortgage installments, okay? And let's say that in the 90s, the actual 30-year mortgage rate back then was about 10%, okay? So you had to pay a 10% nominal mortgage rate for 30 years. And with a $1,000 mortgage installment budget per month, that meant at these interest rates that you could buy a house worth about $120,000 back in the 90s. Okay, now let's bring this back 30 years forward, okay? And let's go specifically to 2021. I just want to show you the peak euphoria of this wealth illusion paradigm, as I call it. Let's say that you are in 2021 and you still want to spend $1,000 a month in mortgage installments. That's your budget. But your 30-year mortgage is now 3%. So you do your calcs and all of a sudden you can afford a house worth $240,000. This is double the price in the 90s. So effectively, by lowering nominal interest rates over time, you have allowed another generation to lever up more and more and more, specifically to double the amount of the 90s and be able to afford the same price. And so what you have achieved is a continuous use of leverage and injection of leverage into the economy, which makes not only the new buyer feel like he can afford new credit simply because interest rates have gone down, specifically the old buyer particularly happy, because his house price is now double in price and still can find a buyer because interest rates are much lower than they were in the 90s. So the combination of lower interest rates and injection of credit into the economy makes this offsetting effect, basically, or what I call the wealth illusion paradigm, actually go further and further. And the reason why I call it the wealth illusion paradigm is that where you forced to rapidly reverse this interest rate story and move back from 3% to 7 or 8 or 9 or 10% and stay there for a while, so find a new equilibrium borrowing rate, a bit like it happened in Japan in the 90s, you're facing the risk that you have to reverse this wealth effect and basically deleverage the entire system.
Right. So how do you see, what are the potential paths forward on this? I mean, we've got the tremendous amount of debt. I'm sure the other thing that comes to mind for me too is the initial conditions, right? So again, you started with that many years ago with very low, much lower debt across both public and private sectors. So you've got this space in front of you to lever up. You've got high interest rates going to low interest rates. So you have this sort of perfect storm of opportunity to create the wealth illusion effect. What happens going forward from here? When we're at 5% interest rates, do we need a massive productivity growth? Are we going to see, you know, some sort of the classic, there's three ways out of it, you know, debt, you can be austere. Nobody likes to do that. Nobody gets elected. You can default or you can sort of debase the debt and inflate it away. So those are kind of the three paradigms that people talk a lot about. How do you see us resolving this in the path forward, given the current set of circumstances?
I mean, what politicians are doing right now is, while the central bank is trying to act somehow responsible by raising interest rates to fight inflation, that puts a lot of burden on a highly leveraged system. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening on the other side is that governments are coming in with fiscal injections, right? They're being much more friendly on the fiscal side, hoping to basically balance out this tightening from the Federal Reserve and other central banks and come in supporting the private sector on the other hand of it. Now, can this work? Again, yes, as a fragile equilibrium, as long as bond vigilantes and markets don't start questioning this gigantic use of fiscal stimulus in a pro-cyclical way and start wondering, you know, let's put a premium on long bonds. Let's see what happens there, for example. So this could be a release valve for how the system becomes all of a sudden very fragile. Going forward, let's even assume, right, that we go back to a situation where you have a perfect soft landing. It's disinflationary. So the Federal Reserve can cut rates all the way to 2%, right? So we go back on this treadmill, basically, of let's try to put new leverage at cheaper interest rates, okay? Even if we go towards that, there are limitations because, as you said, the private sector is much more leveraged than before in general. Not specifically in the United States, but if you look around the world, right, that is the case. You are in a situation where you then slowly but surely move back towards low interest rates. So your ability to lower interest rates further becomes limited, right? So there are obvious limitations. And this is why I think people feel uncomfortable with the system, right? They feel it needs to crack. So then the piece was there to try and answer the question, what is the macro endgame? What are the solutions to this, right? Mm-hmm. So I see three. The first one is politicians would show up and say, sorry, guys, we're going to clean up the mess. So we're going to go with a gentle deleveraging. They would like to be gentle, but with a deleveraging process. I think that's pretty much politically inviolable because you would have to deleverage a wealth illusion effect system and a levered up system that has benefited two generations. That would be a disaster. And even if it's true that, let's say, after 2028 in the US, the majority of voters isn't going to be the boomers or the people who benefit most from this, still they would account for like 40% of the voters. So I'm not sure that any politician would volunteer to actually deleverage the system. Would you agree with me?
Yeah. And I think the political system in the US is quite unique with all of these baby boomers and even older generations holding positions of power politically. And you have this massive voting group called the millennials. And why are they going to endure austerity for their grandparents' sake? Like, what's the motivation for them to eat this particular shit sandwich?
Correct.
So that older generation, which is clinging to power in a political sense and driving the bus still and still votes predominantly much more than the millennials vote. It's a very unlikely scenario where we get the austerity deleveraging without some sort of war or some sort of call to action that, you know, sort of solidifies the population across the generation. So yes, I agree.
I think you're right. And specifically, China has recently tried to deleverage a bit their system, and they're not doing particularly well as a result. I mean, the Chinese real estate market was valued at, I think, $50 trillion at the end of 2021. That's a bigger market cap than the US stock market.
Right.
And Xi Jinping said, well, you know what? That's a bit too much, right? Should we try to deleverage this sector? And China, which is a centrally planned economy, still got a lot of backlash from this, attempt at deleveraging. So it's very hard in general to deleverage a very leveraged system. And on top of it, it wouldn't really benefit the status quo, I would argue. So politically inviolable, low likelihood. What's the second solution? The one we were suggesting, hinting at before, which is wealth redistribution. So what you do there is you don't try to necessarily deleverage the system, but you simply try to shuffle around basically the wealth distribution. So you do targeted fiscal policies to make sure that some of the wealth that has been allocated to a certain cohort of the population gets moved around basically to another cohort of the population. Mm-hmm. So wealth redistribution. In my opinion, this is more politically viable simply because the majority of voters will be very happy with wealth redistribution, let's be frank. But it is also a very volatile outcome because when you redistribute wealth, you're also changing basically the consumption patterns in the economy. So you're moving money towards the higher cohorts of the population that are the more, they have the highest propensity to consume, basically. So what you're doing there is you're really applying tectonic shifts at how economic resources are allocated. That's a very volatile outcome, which I think is still politically viable and likely. And what this does is it brings more vol, more inflation risks, more stagflation risks to the economy. So I think this is an outcome where this could be the macro endgame or a step towards the macro endgame. And I think that investors aren't necessarily prepared in their portfolio for more periods of inflation vol, more periods of stagflation. I think this could be one of the most likely solutions. What do you say?
Yeah, I think that was also talked about a little bit in the Fire and Ice by AHL Mann piece, if anyone wants to look that up, where they looked at inflation volatility previous to sort of 1990 versus what we've had from 1990 to today. And, you know, correct me going from memory, but inflation volatility has been post-1990 has been half of what it was in the previous period. So, you know, you had a couple of world wars, you had a Great Depression, you didn't have quite the coordinated central bank efforts, and you didn't have this wonderful starting place where you'd ratcheted rates up to 18% to purge the system of debt and then set the stage for a wonderful levering of the economy. So, you know, yeah, I think that is an interesting scenario. What always triggers my thoughts in this is the really rich seem to figure out ways in which to work around a lot of these situations. So, you know, as much as you have smart people in government trying to think through ways in which to make the tax system more fair and redistribute wealth, at the same time, you have very wealthy individuals who have, you know, legions of lawyers and tax structures set up to simply counteract those policies and programs. That's not to say that it's not possible. It's just that, you know, you kind of have to have buy-in from everybody that we're going to do this.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, the geopolitical side of things where nations are competing with one another. You have the Japanese scenario where you've got the yen falling through the floor, making that particular economy pretty competitive. And then what's the game theoretic of all the economies of the world trying to redistribute wealth at the same time, but also trying to compete with one another?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're totally right. It's much easier said than done. Nevertheless, a potentially likely outcome, or more likely than the first.
Yeah.
The third one.
Well, there's going to be levers, right? I don't think any one of these is going to be the thing. The other thing is it's probably going to be a combination of some of these three things together in some way, shape, or form.
Correct.
But definitely more of this one.
The third one is simply kick the can down the road, right? So pretend that nothing's going on and have the system lever up a bit further, maybe try to cut interest rates or try to control the situation like today where interest rates are high, but fiscal deficits are trying to pick up the slack. And I think that's what politicians probably go the most for, because their objective number one is to preserve the status quo. So as you said, there are like three ways to face this going forward. And I think number three, preserving the status quo, is what politicians want, but it's going to be a bit more, you know, intervaled by step number two, which is wealth redistribution policies to try and gain more voters and try to make the system a bit more balanced. So what I'm looking at is situations where if you think about how to position a portfolio for something like that, there's a chart in the article that shows the LCTM NAV, right, the net asset value of a dollar invested there. And, you know, if you would understand straight in 1994 and what LPCM was doing was basically levering up on illiquidity and relative value that really was more illiquidity premium than anything else, you would say, look, if these guys keep doing this, at some point they're going to blow up, right? There's going to be a situation where they're going to blow up. And you had to wait 4 years until that payoff came, right? There is a chart that says you can basically mirror it if you're trying to bet against them, and you will lose money for 4 years, and then you would make a ton of money, right? And then I say, look, if you want to time or trade the macro endgame as a binary outcome, basically what you're looking at is potentially a few decades of underperformance. And none of us are in the business of underperforming for more than actually a few quarters, unfortunately, how the financial industry is set up nowadays.
Right.
So we have to find ways to incorporate, I think, these probabilities into a framework, into a portfolio, so that you can build something that is relatively well balanced and doesn't necessarily underperform while you preserve some convexity towards a scenario where one of these macro endgame solution actually pops up, right? And I think right. that's the aim, and it's important to pass it through as a message. Don't binary trade something which is potentially decades to go, because it's going to cost you a fortune to do that, and maybe the payoff comes way too late for you to actually be able to benefit from it.
Exactly. And there's a lot in that. So LTCM, the Thai baht, the Russian ruble, and then the Fed's decision by Greenspan to loosen because the financial global system was in jeopardy was probably one of the causes of the NASDAQ going from 2000 to 5000, right? We have the correction in 98. LTCM gets worked out. There's a massive injection of global liquidity. And then you have a technology bubble. That is to some degree what the US may be facing yet again, in that if we have something that causes a global breaking of something, and then the US has to decide whether it prioritizes the global stability over the US inflationary stability. So how much will the US, if it had to loosen rates because something breaks globally, what are the implications for an inflationary situation for the US population and for those, that large swath of voters that isn't rich? You know, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, 25% increase in the cost of living is extremely difficult, and it is heartfelt, and you have a vote in that. So there's lots of unintended consequences that come from the central bank's interventions and these three levers that they're trying to work through: kick the can, slightly delever, redistribute wealth, in a world where inflation volatility goes up dramatically, which then, of course, I think, as you're alluding to, and I will second, is that now you need a framework that considers all of those issues, that considers the implications to asset prices. How are you going to balance those exposures? How are you going to add a global macro framework to your asset allocation system? Because we are not today starting at 18% interest rates going to zero. We're not sitting at a very lowly levered economy. We're sitting at, you know, high rates in a high levered economy. Sure, we've got some ability to cut, but that is what makes global macro so popular, or so potentially profitable, in thinking through how you might balance your exposures. And as you say, you don't want to bet on these things in a binary fashion. You want to Correct. Think through the probabilities of them and probability weight some of your thinking. And you probably need a base portfolio to think through, to think about bets against a base portfolio as well.
Yeah. So I would say the first step to do here is to say, if I get somewhere along the road a higher probability of one of these macro endgame outcomes to become more likely, how is my portfolio going to react? Do a mental stress test, basically, of one of these, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say that, for example, let's not even talk about the macro endgame, but a simple situation where inflation picks up, and in 2022, which was the result of 2020 and 2021, not wealth redistribution, but simply fiscal interventions to make sure that, you know, the system could continue to exist during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so the result was inflation, because the US ended up doing too much and there were supply bottlenecks and so on and so forth. So what happened back then? Well, as my friend Dan Rasmussen from Verdad Capital, he has a very good chart where he goes back, I think, 150 years and looks at the 3-year rolling correlation between bonds and stocks, right? And then he looks at that level of correlation pending or conditional of the level of core inflation that is prevailing, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's a very simple chart where you see this negative correlation existing mostly in periods where inflation is between 1 and 2.5%. You know, when inflation is between 1 and 2.5, bonds and stocks are negatively correlated. It makes all the sense in the world, because if something goes poor, let's say in earnings or in the real economy, the central bank will cut rates. You know, they have inflation at their target level, would actually even maybe lower. So they can and will cut the interest rates, and this will benefit bonds. And therefore, this negative correlation exists very, very well documented through decades, mm-hmm. when core inflation is between 1 and 2.5%. But the chart also shows how the correlation turns positive when core inflation is above 3%, and particularly when it's very volatile, you know, and ranging between 2 and 4 and 3 and 5. And then the correlation becomes positive. And that's exactly what we saw in 2022, right? So stress testing your portfolio mentally would basically bring you to a situation where if you're running only bonds and stocks, I'm sorry, but you have two items, they're both going to go down at the same time. And I'm gonna also say that the 60-40 portfolio is 85% equity vol in the first instance. And so your job is also somehow correlated to the business cycle and to equity and to earnings. And so if everything is falling down and your job is more at risk and your portfolio is facing a 20% drawdown, I'm going to argue that is not necessarily a robust framework to invest, right. Especially if you think these vol events, so let's say wealth redistribution, fiscal deficits, high inflation, low inflation, more volatility is going to pop up, right? You need something else. You need to mental stress your portfolio before we even talk about sources of uncorrelated returns, so alphas like carry or trend or global macro. We first need to fix the beta. Like, do you have exposure to different beta elements that will contribute to stabilize your returns if the macro environment is not what you have seen for the last 10, 15 years? So disinflationary growth driven by the US. If you have any other outcome, which is maybe inflationary growth or deflation or growth outside the US, is your portfolio, from a beta perspective, prepared to really benefit from this environment, different lenses?
So right on the mark there, Alf. The way you get to the current situation we're in is you have this positive reinforcement, this recency bias, where investors have been treated so well by a disinflationary growth environment. Market cap weighted strategies are now way over in the disinflationary growth camp. If we take the S&P 500 and say, well, okay, you know, we use a lot of energy in our global economy. And, you know, it's said that an AI search now takes 17 times more energy than a Google search once did.
Yeah.
So we have a very energy intense economy. Yet, if you look at the S&P 500 at the moment, 4% of the S&P 500 is energy. 2% is materials. So what is your hedge in the situation where we get into a stagflationary environment where the cost of inputs to production, energy, and so on are rising rapidly? That takes profits out of the rest of the 96% of the S&P 500. And you've got nothing in your portfolio that is adding positive returns if you're in a stagflation environment where growth is threatened by maybe the cost of inputs or debt or other things. So you have a totally imbalanced portfolio. You're basically letting the maniacs run the asylum here, right? But feels okay right now. 2022 was just like a little appetizer in that scenario. So, I mean, people have this recency bias. They're going to do what has been the, you know, sort of Pavlovian or habit-based response that they've had over the last 20 years. They've been trained very well to buy the dips. I think, you know, you probably get a Pavlovian response in a growth threatened environment where bonds do rally in some way, but I don't think that rally is going to be what it has been in the past. Because if you're injecting that stimulus, then on the other side of the equation is, okay, well, who's going to pay off the bonds? Like, how do we pay off all this debt that's accumulated, and what's the credit rating on those bonds? So how do you fill out the portfolio? Like, we have this, you know, largely sort of, maybe we've reached peak passive, peak market cap, which has been dominated by a disinflationary growth environment, which means largely US equities are the largest piece of any sort of market cap portfolio. How do we protect ourselves going forward? What do we need to incorporate, and what do we do in a global macro framework from your perspective in order to round this out?
Look, I think on the betas, your most famous betas are equities, bonds, and I would say there is commodities as well as a beta you can try to achieve, and potentially the dollar, which is an interesting beta as well. And then you can, you know, just look at, for example, on equities, you can do internationally diversified to protect you against the outcome that growth comes from outside the US. You can do equal weight rather than market cap weighted to make sure that, you know, you have a broader exposure to the equity market. And on bonds, you know, you can do different points of the curve. So especially through futures, you can use very little cash to get your bond exposure and get a certain amount of volatility out of the bonds, because often, you know, in the 60-40, you will target intermediate bonds. They have very low duration, very low sensitivity to move to interest rates. And therefore, you will need a ton of them to make sure that they contribute actively as a defender in this inflationary environment. So again, through futures, you can structure that in a more interesting way than just targeting your 5 or 7 year bonds. And then you have commodities, and then we go towards the more defensive side of things. Okay, what if there is inflation, for example? So how do we work around that? Well, if there is inflation, you can think of commodities, but you can even think of strategies that actually benefit from inflationary environments. So in 2022, we saw the rise, I think, or the comeback, I should say, of trend strategies. So these are strategies that, you know, basically make money when there is a clear breakout in prices. And when does that happen? Well, when there is a lot of macro volatility, you would expect, right, that there are more convex reactions in prices, and therefore trend strategies can actually benefit from this ability. And you can see that trend strategies tend to do pretty well during inflationary bouts, exactly for this reason, because you need to restructure the way you think about interest rates and equity sectors and commodity prices. And so you have a lot of trends developing, and you can benefit from an allocation to trend. So we are now moving from the structuring the beta in a smart way, sizing it correctly through futures, looking at international diversification, into more, let's say, the alpha side of things, or the uncorrelated stream of returns, or the defenders. And so when you look at defenders, I think trend does a great job at being a potential defender. And then there are strategies that are a mix of defenders and uncorrelated stream of returns. And I think global macro is in that category, because a good global macro strategy, what it does is it looks at idiosyncratic opportunities popping up around the world because of macro volatility. So it doesn't necessarily need a trend to develop somewhere, but it needs a set of idiosyncratic opportunities available. This might be in the shape of the yield curve, in how interest rates are priced between countries, maybe Europe versus the US, maybe in equities versus each other, so Chinese equities versus US equities. It just needs a set of idiosyncratic opportunities that are popping up because of more global macro volatility, right? And so it's a strategy that can do well, let's say, in normal times, but it's expected to do particularly well when there are clusters of volatility, right? And that's, it's a mix between a relative value neutral type of strategy and a defensive payoff, which tends to do well, particularly when macro volatility is picking up. So you think of all this potential stream of returns, and you guys with the return stacking concept are popularizing that very well, I think, because you basically are very optimal in how you spend your cash to obtain your beta, your S&P, your bonds, your standard beta, right? You obtain that with little cash, and then you all of a sudden freed up some of your notional to invest in these strategies, which you, as you correctly say, you can stack on top of your betas. And then you have your standard balanced portfolios betas plus your new attackers, your new uncorrelated strategies, your new defenders in an alpha format, because you have freed up the cash to allocate to those.
Yeah, love that. And so for those who might be listening that aren't sure, don't know what managed futures are and that sort of thing, there is on the Return Stack Portfolio Solutions webpage, we published a managed futures trend following sort of a educational piece to help, you know, elucidate some of the things that Alf's talking about here as well. And the other thing in trend is that you can be long or short. And I think that's another thing that benefits, as well as the position sizing you talked about, right? So it's, you know, it's not a capital allocation of 40%. You do it on a risk allocation. So you can size your bonds to have an impact on your portfolio that's beneficial during those dark times. One other string I want to pull back into this to make it very clear for people out is we were talking about inflation volatility previously. When you have very low inflation volatility and you have a stable environment from the late 80s until 2022, you don't have a lot of these dislocations. They just occur less often, and it makes those types of managed futures and trend following strategies, they just have less opportunity. But if you look outside of those periods, pre-1990 and now post-2022, what you get are these dislocations created by fiscal policy, central bank policy, the realities of debt and leverage in the system, where these types of strategies that Alf was talking about actually have more of an opportunity to impart value to the portfolio. So not only do you need to structure your beta thoughtfully to think through all of the allocations and the different regimes that may occur, but then your hedge or your explore portion of your portfolio, that attackers and defenders, actually has more opportunity to provide greater value in this current paradigm.
Yeah. Also, the reason why I am launching my global macro hedge fund as well in the fourth quarter of the year. If you look at how politicians are using fiscal, it used to be actually a anti-cyclical lever, right? I mean, politicians would look at the economy. If it would weaken, they would do more fiscal deficits. If it would strengthen, they would pull a little bit back. Now it's not the case. It seems to be more a feature than a bug or an anti-cyclical tool. It's just all over the place. And this increases the chance that there's going to be more macro vol down the road. And if you look at changing demographics and you look at, you know, the green transition, there are so many moving parts out there for which I think macro vol is going to increase. And so you look, if you have this view that macro vol is going to increase, then as you said, you not only have to look at your betas very carefully, but also consider an allocation to other strategies, more on the alpha side, let's say, that are able to diversify your return. So global macro, for example, did particularly well in 2022, a year which was very, very volatile for macro in general, and then it saw your betas do particularly poorly. So that's bonds and equities, they did particularly poorly, and global macro did very well. If you expect more years ahead that are as volatile potentially, then you need stabilizers in your portfolio. I personally expect a lot of macro vol, and that's the reason why my macro hedge fund launches in Q4.
Yeah, let's talk about how you've thought through the structure there. We've got about 10 minutes left to kind of sit and explain to us how you've thought through your betas. And, well, first of all, are you stacking betas and alphas together? How are you thinking through the beta side? How are you thinking through the alpha side? And then how are you combining the two? And I think if you can, you know, enlighten everyone on that. And then obviously, if you do see this and you are interested in what Macro Alphs is talking about for later this year, make sure you get in and send them a DM or, you know, get on Substack and get on the Macro Compass and let them know. And yeah, make sure you're in line for when the launch occurs.
Yeah.
But yeah, take us through the structure.
Yeah. So for me, the aim is the following. If I launch a global macro strategy, do you need me to run beta for you? The answer is no, you don't. You don't need me to run beta for you because I'm not paid for that. You can achieve beta, for example, through return stacking products in a very cheap and efficient way or in any other way you prefer. But it's generally pretty cheap to get intelligent exposure to beta, I would say. So I instead am running strategies that are market neutral. They try to have a filter for S&P 500, Treasury beta, the standard betas, to have as little beta exposure as possible in the fund and to instead deliver a stream of return, which is positively skewed, as we would define it, and it benefits the most during clusters of macro volatility. So this is a strategy that basically looks at idiosyncratic opportunities. It looks at interest rates, at equity markets, at currency markets, at commodity markets from a global perspective, and it tries to identify this location. We think in probabilities, so we always look at different scenarios. We have various models that look at scenarios and how markets are pricing them in probability terms, where consensus is, and we try to look at potential catalysts for these locations. We say, look, if the market, for example, from, let's take a look at the Fed funds today, right? And what the market is thinking about the distribution of these returns, of the outcomes for the Fed. I think it's a good example for how we think about it. So if you take a look at this chart right here, it shows the distribution of probabilities, the top chart here, for Fed funds future in 12 months from today. So we're looking at what the market thinks Fed funds will be in 12 months from now. But instead of looking at one number, we're looking at the probability distribution. Okay, so I derived this by looking at options that are underlying the future contracts. And what it's telling me now, if you look at the summary table here, is that a recession in the US or cuts that are in line historically with the recession in the US are priced by the market at a 5% probability. 5%. So what do I think about that probability? Well, historically, you have a recession in any given year with about a 10% chance. You have a recession every 10 years in the US, okay? So now you're getting this tail price at a 5% probability. That's relatively cheap, I would say. So you start thinking like, I don't think the US will be in a recession necessarily in 1 year, but if you think in probabilities, you just need this distribution to shift a bit over time your way, and you can structure option payoffs that will pay very handsomely if that transition happens. And then you look at this and you say, hey, the model outcome of this distribution, the most observed outcome, is actually zero cuts. So the market is fully gone in now on the idea that the Federal Reserve will not cut interest rates at all over the next 12 months. Actually, there is even a tail right here for hikes. Mm-hmm. Now the market is starting to price in a relevant probability that the Federal Reserve might hike rate, a model outcome of no cuts at all, and an only 5% probability of a recession going forward. So now, how do you think about this? It's like, okay, if I need to take a position here, then I can think of a structure that might bet on the idea the economy maybe weakens a little bit going forward, doesn't need to end in a recession, but as long as this distribution shifts to the left over time, shifts towards more cut, you can benefit from it, even if ultimately you don't have a recession, just by understanding how consensus is positioned, how the tails are priced, and thinking in probabilities. That's what we do a lot in the macro fund and in the framework we have created.
Right. And you're doing that across, I'm assuming, the rates, some stocks, but not in a correlated sort of beta buy and hold type of thing. All the commodity space, currencies.
Correct. So we trade mostly futures because it's the most liquid way to do that. We will then do swaps and other derivatives where it's the most optimal way to express this, but we will do it correct across asset classes and across geographies. And the idea is to identify these dislocations and see how the market is, the consensus is pricing certain distribution, finds this dislocation and get in. So if there is macro vol, if there are these classes of volatility, you have positions on that might allow you to benefit from it. And actually you serve the role in the client portfolio. And the role is, and when your betas are not working because of that cluster of volatility, you are there to offer them diversification benefits and actually upside returns.
Wonderful. And then last question, I know because we're running out of time here, but how do you think about the assembly of that sort of set of trades? So you're going to see some stuff in the rates world. You might see some opportunities in commodity space and then a currency trade or two, something in Woody Ball world or, you know, relative value or whatever comes up. Yeah. How are you thinking about positioning those trades across the entire portfolio?
So what we do is we apply a inverse volatility mechanism to size the trade. So we are looking basically at having a set of uncorrelated trades in the portfolio, mm-hmm. all contributing the same amount of risk and volatility to the fund. And the idea is very simple. Ex ante, you never know when you're right and you never know when you're wrong, right? You only set positions on based on your initial idea that your expected value is positive, but ex ante, we're going to see what's positive or what's not. So the idea is you size them all in a way that they contribute equally to the risk of the portfolio, because as a macro manager, you are right 50 to 55% of the times. Unless you're selling volatility, which is not what we do, you are right 50 to 55% of the times. So what you want is that when you are right, actually, when you're wrong, each of these uncorrelated trades can contribute only to a maximum capped amount of loss in your fund, right? But when you are right, you have strategies in place, either through an option payoff or a trailing profit strategy, to be able to extend the right side of your returns.
Right.
And so by doing this, even being right only 50% of the times, as long as the portfolio construction and the risk sizing process is accurate, you actually can get positively skewed returns at a fund level.
Absolutely. And that's a bit of an ensemble as well, where you're taking many, many sources of information and sources of return, combining them together. You get the noise canceling out. You get some signal in there. You get some positive return. And you've got a very diversified portfolio that is quite different from traditional betas that make it so complementary in a portfolio.
Yes. And for me, it's really simple. I'm an open book over to being on social media through research. So also for this adventure, pretty simple. If anyone is interested, they can shoot me an email. fund@themacrocompass.com is the address. The Macro Compass is the symbol that you see there on my back, so you can't miss it. fund@themacrocompass.com. You send me a message, I will take a look at it. We can have a chat. I'm very open. Part of the diversification, I would say, of this fund is that I will be the opposite of your standard macro manager who you only hear during tax season maybe and through some investment letters. I'm very open to discuss the ways I can help potential investors. So just send me a message and I'll pick it up.
Amazing. Thanks so much, Alf, for your time today. And as he said, the Macro Compass on Substack, as well as at Macro Alf on Twitter, is where you can find this brainiac of the macro world. And one of our favorite guests, Alf, thanks so much for joining us again today. And we look forward to chatting in the future.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening. You will find all the information we highlighted in this episode by visiting investresolve.com/podcasts. We also encourage you to engage with us on Twitter by searching the handle @InvestResolve. If you're enjoying the series, please take the time to share us with your friends through email or social media. And if you really learned something new and believe that this podcast would be helpful to others, we would be incredibly grateful if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks again, and see you next time.